none. Number 17, none. How many people have none? Oh, wow, there we go. So, 2 points. Okay. So, you have to bring it to me so we can, you know, check it against your argument. Okay, we will do a review today, but before we do the review, and you have a handout for the review, we'll talk more about some good stuff. So when last we talked about the strep organisms, we talked about a little bit about pneumonia, indicating where it might cause problems in the respiratory tract, the eye, pink eye, that kind of stuff. Bacterial meningitis, we talked about bacterial meningitis. We talked a little bit about some of the clinical clues that we expect to find in the spinal cord today. She's over with us the last hour. We didn't know much about her. Don't know where she is or where she did. Most of the area, so basically, we talked about the Neisseria meningitidis as an example of bacterial meningitis and what we might expect to find in the spinal fluid in terms of the type of cells, oh my goodness, I'm leaving already, I just got started. At any rate, we have the possibility of also a problem that may develop, which is very fatal, and that is the septal myxomatosis with the adrenal glands, and that was Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. Sort of an unusual name, but it counts for about 90% of fatalities. The other 10% fatalities are the indicator patients, that is, they go the longest before treatment. We also gave an aspect to that in which we expect to find higher levels of antibodies in the spinal fluid of those patients, as opposed to a patient that was not gone for a long time without treatment. We also mentioned that the variant factor for Neisseria meningitidis is going to be capsular protein, capsular sugars, and that we have a vaccine that most people who are freshmen or military recruits are given. Basically, by the time you make it to Christmas, your need for the vaccine has dropped off significantly. Now, that doesn't mean we don't give it if you haven't received it, but the real danger period is really in the fall semester for college freshmen or military recruits in the first few months. So all of that was about Neisseria meningitidis. Okay. New material would be bacterium diphtheriae. We know that carinibacterium diphtheriae. Ah, yes. Up there somewhere. Yeah. No, then we don't see things right in front of ourselves. Possible. Well, we don't know what it is.
Russ may have moved it down there. I don't know.
All right. Very good. It was tough to work. All right. So sorry for accusing you of walking out with it. It said you had the last hour, so I in a street that's been perpendicular to that street, we add a filter paper of antibodies to the toxin. And as the organism grows in the auger and secretes the exotoxin, it will diffuse into the auger. Meanwhile, at right angles to that, we have the filter paper that is impregnated with the antitoxin, which then also now diffuses into the auger, and when the antitoxin, which is soluble, and the toxin, which is soluble, come together, they form an immune complex that is insoluble, resulting in a line of precipitation. And so we can identify then the actual production of the toxin from that isolate of the patient. Because not all isolates of the organism produce the toxin, because it's not as bacterial genomic information, but that rather the viral information. Now we have a series of interesting skin tests that are involved with checking to see if you are susceptible to diphtheria. Now these skin tests are not commonly used because of a massive immunization attempt in the United States and in large parts of the developed world. It's part of our DPTs. D is diphtheria toxoid. P is pertussis, which is whooping cough, Bordetella pertussis, which is a kill preparation of the organism. And the T is tetanus toxoid. So two toxoids, tetanus toxoid and diphtheria toxoid, are in that mixture. So we have then lots of immunization with the antibody present in the population at high levels. But in those parts of the world where that's not common, and in the time earlier, before we had mass immunization in the developed world, we have a skin test that's useful. And that's another example of a skin test that we need to be aware of. And this skin test is a little different than the Dick test. It's called the Schick test. The Schick test, like the people who make razor blades and things like that, the Schick test, right? The Schick test, we take the we take the toxin and we dilute it out. It's still active toxin, but it's diluted out, much as we did in the first scarlet fever. And we inject that in the skin, and within about 24 hours, we will see a redness in the area around that injection site, indicating the person does not have protective levels of the antibody. So red reaction, just as in the Dick test, both Dick and Schick test will tell us a red reaction in 24 hours that you don't have the antibody, that you are susceptible. However, in this setting, we have another complication. After 48 hours at that same site, some individuals will develop an allergic reaction. This is a T-cell-mediated type 4 hypersensitivity, Roman numeral 4. And it will also result in a red reaction. We call that a pseudo-positive if the only reaction you get is the one at 48 hours and you never got one at 24. So if you are not allergic to it and you are susceptible, you will have a red reaction beginning at 24 hours. If you are not susceptible, you will not have a red reaction because you have antibodies that neutralize the toxin. So nothing happens in 24 hours. If you are allergic, you will get a red reaction at 48 hours. Okay. If you're not allergic, you won't have a red reaction at 48 hours. And it gets a little complicated if you have a red reaction at 24 and it's still a little bit there at 48. You know, what's going on? So what we do is we have a second immunization in that person, a second site, given simultaneously to the first, usually the other arm. And in this one, we give the toxoid. So you're not going to have any kind of effect at 24 hours at all. There's no toxin there. It's an alternate form. It's a weak, it's destroyed. So it's not going to stimulate any red reaction at all at 24 hours. However, it will still stimulate an allergic reaction if you are allergic to it. So in one arm we give the toxin, in the other arm we give the toxoid, the small injection sites, and we look for the red reaction. Again, a red reaction at 24 means you don't have the antibodies to be protected, you are susceptible to diphtheria. A A red reaction of 48 hours tells you you're allergic to some component of that agent. So we have some combined reactions and pseudopositive reactions. Combined, you're getting both sides red in 24 hours and 48 hours. Both reactions times. So basically, we have this a complication of sorts. It's certainly designed after the Zig test. Temporally, it was. But we had this other complication. So now we have to realize that when we do skin testing, we have to be aware of the timing of the reaction. If we're using an actual toxin diluted form, because some people will have a red reaction, but it's not because of the toxin, it's because they're allergic to some component. Okay. In those settings, we use the toxoids to distinguish the reactions. Everybody follow that? Okay, so it's just a little nuance. So this will go through any kind of skin testing that we have, particularly if we're using a toxin as our agent. So that's the theory of organism. It can cause a throat infection. It can cause an ear infection, eustachian tube, and middle ear. We can have it in the sinuses. And we can also have it in a wound site, the organism growing in a wound site. They call it wound diphtheria. But the classic one is in the throat, but it's not limited to that. The organism can cause infections in other sites. So we have first an infection, and then we have the intoxication. Now, the toxin itself blocks protein synthesis in eukaryotic cells, that is, your cells, not bacterial prokaryotic cells. It blocks elongation factor number 2. You might have heard of this in biochemistry class. So it blocks the making of the length of the chain of amino acids. Inside the patient's throat, this destruction of cells are being destroyed because they can't produce the proteins results in a thick exudate or a liquid. And this thick exudate begins to gel in the throat. And it's sort of a gray color. And it's sometimes called a pseudomembrane. And it can get away of breathing. Sometimes we remove it. It gets really bad and cut it out. But that's what that pseudomembrane is. It's just a collection of dead cells and components of the cell. Pseudomembrane. Again, we protect our individual against diphtheria by the immunization. Without immunization, this particular agent is extremely, almost explosively, epidemic in nature. An example. Both World War I and World War II, German soldiers invaded Scandinavian countries. Scandinavian countries had very low instances of diphtheria, and so they did not feel the need to immunize their population. Within weeks of the German invasions of both World War I and World War II, soldiers coming from Germany who were, one, immunized, because, two, Germany had a high rate of diphtheria without immunizations, spread the organism amongst the population. And so they would go from one or two cases a month to thousands of cases a month. Okay? So it would be really amazing increase in the number of patients. So in a susceptible population, diphtheria can be a serious health threat. So it's one of those agents that we talk about developing world countries and immunizing and all that sort of stuff. It's certainly on our list because it's easily preventable by immunization with a toxoid, and yet it's easily a very explosive epidemic. It can also trigger fevers in the patient and can result in death of particularly younger children between the ages of, guess what, 3 months and 5 years of age. Haemophilus influenzae. By the way, just to tell you, if you're aware, I can tell you, Streptococcus pneumoniae is a gram-positive organism, coccal in chains. Streptococcus pneumoniae is really short chains, like two. Strepthiocinase is longer chains, again, gram-positive copper. Neisseria meningitidis is a gram-negative copper. Corynes bacteria thuri is a rod, individual cells, gram-positive. Haemophilus influenzae is copper and gram-negative. Haemophilus influenzae can cause sore throats, sinus infections, earaches, conjunctivitis, or cause a pink eye kind of thing. So pink eye, as we commonly call it, in terms of bacterial agents, if you lead to that, we see Streptococcus pneumoniae, and we see Haemophilus influenzae being common causes of that. It has a capsule as its greatest factor, and we do have a vaccine against it, which is going to be, of course, capsular sugars. And there are different serotypes, so you might recognize, like type B on the immunizing agent. We'll see it again when we get to the lower respiratory tract, because it can cause pneumonia and so on, but up in the upper respiratory tract, this organism in roughly your age range, that is generally people from, let's say, 18 to 22, 23, and with everybody, but the common age range in the class. In that age range, it can cause an acute epiglottitis. Remember the epiglottis, that little flap of the tissue that prevents you from aspirating or inhaling water and food and things of that nature. Well, the epiglottis can be invaded by the organism. It's a receptor site matching. It does not seem to affect everyone. And again, the people who are susceptible seem to lose the receptor site after a certain period of time. So you don't seem to have it beyond your mid-20s. It's common. I'll give you a little case study. This was New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago. We had a student, again, just graduated from their undergraduate, started a graduate program in the Boston area. They also were recently married. The fellow, about 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, he has a sore throat. His young wife, only a few months, is very concerned about him, and she urges him to seek medical attention. He resists, but by 6 o'clock, after several hours of discussion, they go to the doctor. Of course, they're new, they don't have a doctor, per se, so they go to the emergency room. The attending physician is a Filipino fellow who, just only a few months before, began his residency. They didn't do that in the middle of summer. So you don't want to get sick and go to the hospital in the middle of summer because everybody is new. At least the first year residents are new. And so this fellow was new to the system, and English wasn't really all that good, and so on and such. And he figures that he has strep throat. So he treats him with penicillin and sends him home, gives him a shot. About 8 o'clock at night, 8:30, 9 o'clock, he's having increasing difficulties in swallowing. He goes back to the emergency room, and to his misfortune, he has the same fellow that he sees, who immediately, upon seeing the patient again, thinks that he's having an allergic reaction to penicillin. Possible. However, he wasn't having an allergic reaction to penicillin. He was having acute epiglottitis. So in an effort to see what was going on, about 11:30 at night, he's still getting worse. He sticks a trach tube down his throat. Doesn't fit because the throat's so swollen, so he ends up using a pediatric trach tube, which is the x-ray at postmortem because he died at that moment. Okay. And so what happens is we have a very irritated tissue. If it's probed with something like a trach tube, it immediately contracts. And so now his trachea has contracted, and he can't breathe. The physician panicked and didn't know what to do, and in the process, the patient died. Now, tracheotomy might have helped, but he didn't think about it quick enough. But that wasn't the physician's only problem. See, remember, he treated him inappropriately, as it turns out, because Haemophilus influenzae, gram-negative organism, is not particularly susceptible to penicillin. And so therefore, it wouldn't be something that he would use anyways. So he used the wrong drug, because he had the wrong idea what the patient's problem was. And then we saw him again, he did not rethink that problem, which is what you need to do. You need to start from the ground zero as you do your clinical decision-making tree. He didn't. He picked up on the branch that he was on, which was the wrong branch. Made the wrong assumptions and began to treat something that wasn't there, the allergic reaction. And by the time that recognized that that wasn't working, it was too late, the patient died. So as a clinical case study, recognize that you're seeing the problem, that it's been already started to be treated and it's not working, go back to ground zero. Go back to the beginning to figure it out. And be careful, be mindful that you may slip into the same faulty thinking that you had the first time. So be very methodical. There's a procedure that you need to follow. And this goes with any kind of problem. Okay? You may get a situation in the hospital from a preceding shift. Now, this is a partially done paperwork. You can finish the job. Or the patient came in from somebody else and they said, well, here's the answer, you just finish it up. Bad idea. Don't trust anyone. In the micro lab, we tell people to rinse their table down at the Rook House. They come in because it was the hour before there was a class in there, and they see it's all wet, and they say, oh, I don't need to use it. How do you know what they did? They did a rinse with water. Don't trust anyone when it has to do with the patient's life. Okay? In this case, you're affecting yourself with something you did and you wrote down. But in the case of the epiglottitis, the patient died because of some wrong assumptions by the physician. Not only was the initial diagnosis wrong, but the follow-up was wrong, and the follow-up was wrong, you were down the wrong path. So when you get a piece of paperwork or a patient partially done, go back to the very beginning. That will frustrate the person that handed on to you because you're questioning me. No, I'm just looking over the data. Now my name is on this sheet. I'm the one responsible. I'm going to start at the beginning. It's a difficult thing to do. You need to develop personal relationships with someone you trust and all that. Don't go there. Just say, well, the procedure says I have to start with page one, number one, and that's where I'm going to go. Okay? So that you confirm what they're doing, possibly, but you are doing it. Because the final analysis, you're going to be signing the sheet because you're the one responsible. And you can't say, well, I thought that Susie, and Susie's not a target there. You are. You're the one who's officially screwed up. Okay? So there's a couple of lessons in that acute epiglottitis. So the physician should have put that into the possibility, like house, and he writes on the chalkboard. Patient, 22-year-old, an acute problem in their throat. This could be epiglottitis. Could be, rule it in, rule it out, but it could be. If you don't think about it, you'll never come up with an answer. What do we got? Oh, styes. This is a staph infection. Okay. Patients see styes, which is a little thing. I'm not going to test you on styes, you know, but you've heard of styes, which is a skin infection. And here you see a roughly cute picture where a stye might be. And here's the official name for this stye, the external portiodium, common stye. So you can see a staph infection. You can see this sort of raised area here. What's happening is, in fact, we have some glands. Don't worry about it. Just get an anatomy, don't worry about it. But basically, these are glands that add fluid to the tear film. Okay? And the tear film's got three layers. The outermost layer, the top layer, is an oily layer. And the oily layer then prevents rapid evaporation of the two aqueous-based layers underneath. So you get this oily layer, and therefore you don't get dry eye and all that kind of stuff. Okay? So here's basically what it is. And you can see here we have Haemophilus influenzae, typing of conjunctivitis, which we talked about. Notice that we have this area of redness around the eye. In addition to, you can see a little bit of exudate there, this is conjunctivitis. Neisseria gonorrhoeae can also cause throat infections. Remember we talked about tromboemboli? So it can cause a throat infection because your septicite patch is there. Remember, it also binds the rectal mucosa. It also binds the cervix and the urethra and so on. It's all that same tissue. It's where common filariae are found. Neisseria gonorrhoeae is a gram-negative diplococcal organism. A little hard to see in this picture, but it really is diplococcal. I think maybe this one gives you a hint of it a little bit better. See, these are really together. So two coccal-shaped organisms, two grams, a gram-negative organism. And this is not a gram stain. You can see the nuclei of it's showing you so you can see it here. So this is a gram-negative diplococcal organism. It's intracellular because those common villi prevent digestion. So they tend to accumulate inside the blood of our cell. We mentioned this before, but now we have a pretty picture. We have a not-so-pretty picture. This is what it looks like in the eye. So you can see this strong inflammatory response. It's redness. You can see a lot of exudate, pus. If you look in there, what you would see was this. The eye tends to swell up like you got hit with a golf ball, so the eye is all swelled up. And get that picture that they just showed you there, you have to sort of open the eye up because it doesn't want to open. Okay. So you open it up and then the pus runs right down the cheek, and in that pus is the organism inside the body itself. We can also have children born of parents who have infections. We can have Neisseria gonorrhoeae causing a problem. Child. Because it's seen at the time of birth and it's an eye infection, it's called ophthalmia neonatorum. Ophthalmia neonatorum, this is a newborn with an eye infection. And Neisseria gonorrhoeae is one common cause. There are others. Pseudomonas can cause infections in the eye in those settings. Chlamydia can cause an infection in the eye. And herpes simplex can cause an infection in the eye. A lot depends on what's involved with exposure at the time of the vaginal delivery. We'll talk more about these kinds of infections. We talked about STDs. But if we have a vaginal delivery and a vaginal area gun organism, the child can get in the eye, and the eye is a common infection site. In the case of herpes simplex, that's more serious. One, it's a viral agent. You have fewer antiviral agents. We have some, but they have some side effects, particularly in the newborn. And if we get an eye infection in the newborn, it can go up the nerve and into the brain if you get encephalitis. And so that's always a serious complication, potential danger. If we have a C-section, some of these are avoidable. Okay. So C-section, not likely to get gonorrhea, not likely to get chlamydia, and so on. But there are agents that we'll talk about later that do cross the placenta and do infect the baby in utero, in which case it doesn't make any difference what the ravage. But for Neisseria gonorrhoeae and chlamydia in particular, this is associated with a bad delivery. More about that detail stuff when we get to the STD. We have what's called an inclusion conjunctivitis, which basically talks about the invasion inside the cells. And of course, chlamydia is an obligate intracellular organism. Okay? And chlamydia has a couple of species, but the most common one is Chlamydia trachomatis. Chlamydia pseudococci is associated with birds. And so if somebody is, they raise pigeons, or they work in the zoo, or something like that. They have a hobby, and they raise lots of birds and so on. That's a possible cause of an eye infection. But the typical one is Chlamydia trachomatis. And you can see that this eye infection is an STD. And chlamydia is the most common STD. And you can see that 3 to 5 million new cases a year. The estimates are hard to get because a lot of times chlamydial infections are asymptomatic, meaning you don't know you have it. General tract infections, eye infections tend to be a little more noticeable, but they are milder in some patients. But certainly the fallopian tubes or the vaginal infection, prostate infection. Those infections tend to be often asymptomatic. So although we have new cases a year, the estimate of the number of people infected in the United States runs as high as 50 million infected. Because many of them are not treated, so you just, you don't treat it, then go away. So it's called an inclusion conjunctivitis because it goes inside the cells. And you can see it here, we have easily seen, but inside here we have the organism. Okay, clumps. This is not very great, but we have clumps inside the cells because that's where it's an obligated cellular organism. And you can see on the inside of the eyelid, you see these lumps. See these lumps? Okay. And what happens is that as you the eyelid is turning inside, you can see it. But what happens is that it builds up scarring here, and then as you blink your eye, you scratch the cornea, and it causes a disease known as trachoma. Now in the United States, we don't see too much trachoma because we treat it at the earlier stage. Okay. But if it goes untreated, particularly in developing world countries, trachoma is a leading cause of blindness. So those of you that do mission work or something along those lines, or volunteer work someplace, if you're in a third world country, this is a big problem. Okay. And again, it needs to be treated before it gets to this stage to prevent scarring and blindness. So respiratory tract, a lot of the agents don't go to the lower respiratory tract, but they have plenty of playgrounds. Ear infections, throat infections, sinus infections, eye infections. Okay? And it's the same guys in the same neighborhood who end up in different places. Lower respiratory tract considerations. Realizing that the lung is a body surface, okay? A body surface. So you're breathing in particles, and the particles and organisms and so on are getting to the lung, and the first contact really with your body in any long-term sense is in your lungs. So it's a surface, just like your gut is a surface. So don't think of your skin being the only surface that you have. And generally, to get a lower respiratory tract infection, that is a pneumonia and so on, there needs to be something that increases the risk for the patient. You said that you have a pretty good defense system. Innate defense system. The cilia moving mucus up and out. We sometimes call that a tracheal toilet. It's sort of an upward flushing. So the cilia, the line of respiratory tract, are moving the mucus to trap the organism up and out. And that's happening all the time. And it's a very, very effective system. We have overrides such as coughing and sneezing. So sneezing gets the organisms out of the nose and nasal passages. We also have mucus inside our nose, and we have nasal hair, and the hairs get coated with mucus, and that traps dust, which carries the organisms. Nasal hair also creates turbulence, which makes the passage from the outside in longer, turbulence. All of that is a very effective mechanism of preventing disease. So therefore, if we get disease, something has to neutralize that to increase the risk of getting infection in the lung. So we have predisposing factors. These are patient factors that increase the likelihood of getting infection. And the first part of the list is shown here. Extremes of age. I put age in quotes because we're always dealing not with chronological age. How old are you? But your physiological age. How fit are you? So a 70-year-old fellow who just ran a marathon is probably in better shape in many respects than a 35 or 40-year-old person who doesn't take care of themselves, smokes four packs of cigarettes a day, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so it's age, yes, but with some common sense addition to that in terms of the overall physiology of the patient. Aspiration, extremes of age, also we have the younger children. okay? So 3 months to 5 years of age. So we have the extremes. 3 months to 5 years of age, and then we have the, quote, older population with some degree of variability. That's the chronological age that we do. Aspiration is the inhalation of fluid. You might think of a near drowning episode. That would be aspirating Lake Michigan or something. Maybe if your epiglottis is relaxed because you just had a fifth of vodka or something like that. So drinking can result in a relaxed epiglottis, and that results in aspiration. The late night food sandwich goes down the wrong tube, so to speak, right? And you aspirate food. People aspirate vitamins and pills. Either they take 19 at one time, get them all at once, and then aspirate a pill. And so people can aspirate things. It's getting them into the lungs. Intubation is the use of a mechanical tube system to keep the lungs inflated while one is unconscious in surgery. And so the anesthesiologist early on before the procedure has to insert a trach tube. It's a little tricky to get the hang of it, but the angle of the neck has to be the right angle and all that. But nonetheless, we can have intubation. The longer you are in surgery, the greater the likelihood that because of the intubation, you will aspirate fluid. Now, to prevent that, we also have medications that are given to the patient that will decrease secretion, particularly in the upper respiratory tract. This is why patients fall in surgery have this dry mouth kind of thing, because they do have a dry mouth, because we deliberately dried out that respiratory tract, because we don't want them aspirating fluid. But nonetheless, mechanical breathing apparatuses, such as the intubation, or if we put the patient on a respirator, that's another issue. Now, we put them on a respirator because they're not mechanically breathing, and they need ventilation, they need more oxygen. But that itself, if they have an infection in the lung or something, but that in itself is, presents a hazard. So we want the patients off the respirator as soon as we can, because that's not a natural phenomenon of breathing. So intubation and all that are a problem. Physical changes, physical status changes of the lower respiratory tract. This is many different things. It could be a patient with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema kind of problems, chronic smokers. It could be someone who works and has an industrial exposure to dust. There's different names for the various kinds of exposures. If you're exposed to asbestos, it's called asbestosis. If you're exposed to coal dust, black lung disease, called silicosis. So there's a variety of different kinds of things, but the common feature is you're breathing in small particles. It would be the same sort of problem we see someone whose summer job is cleaning out silos, for example, and there's all this dust from wheat or corn or whatever was in the silo, and it's just a fine dust that can lead to physical changes in lower respiratory tract. What happens is that you have a scarring that occurs, and that scarring, as a result of the inflammation that was triggered by the dust, that scarring then makes that area of the lung not effective. We also have circulatory dynamics that can change in patients. A patient that has upper cardiac insufficiency, they have a bowel problem or something along those lines, and we end up with fluid building up around the heart in the pericardial sac, or fluid building up around the lungs in the pleural cavity. That will result in an unusual circulatory dynamics, and that will lead to change, physical changes in the lower respiratory tract. Therefore, individuals who have a history of heart disease or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or asthma, another one, leads to scarring of the lungs, all these patients then are at risk of getting infections. So that's why we talked about certain people should get this flu vaccine. Okay? Because they have changes in their lower respiratory tract, which put them at risk of getting an infection in the lung. And so as we try to triage and determine who gets H1N1 vaccines first, by the way, it's coming on campus soon, those who get it first are the ones at greatest risk. How do we know if you're at greatest risk? Well, you're on this list. Well, let's see, what other physical changes? If you're someone who's had surgery, we get you up and walking around. Okay, you just had surgery, you broke your leg in 9 places, and they had an external stabilizer on, and all looks like they're gross and everything else, and they have you up and walking around. People walking in the hallway all the time with IVs in their arm, and they just let them rest. Well, you may recall from an anesthesiology class that when you are walking, the act of walking means that you actually have the foot strike, and then you lift off, and you squeeze your calf, and so on, and all of that pushes venous return back to the heart. If we don't do that, we don't have normal circulatory dynamics, we have cooling of the blood in the legs, and the legs start to swell up, and all that. But besides that, and in addition to that, the patient also has poor circulatory system in the heart, fluid starts building up around the heart, and we end up with increased risk of getting pneumonia. So you start off with a broken leg, but because we were so nice to you in the hospital that you rest, you lie flat on your back for 2 weeks, well, now you get pneumonia. That's why if a person breaks one leg, they have a certain risk. If you break both legs, it's harder to get you up walking around, and therefore suddenly you have a significant increased risk of getting pneumonia. Remember an early morning case, a graduate student in Buffalo Medical School, I had labs in different places, and one of them was in the basement of a hospital. And weird things happen. You find truly weird things happen in hospitals. Hospitals are a place to stay away from in most cases unless you're working there. If you're really, really sick, then I guess you have to go there for as short a time as possible. I remember one Monday morning they were looking for a body. They lost the body because they come into work and infected them. It was out in the hallway, and somebody took the body to x-ray. It's in the bag and everything else, and they took it back. They lost it. The police are looking all over my lab, looking for a body. I found an outside x-ray. But the other thing that we see is the case where a person was on a motorcycle at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they broke their right leg, and they called the orthopedic surgeon in at 4 o'clock in the morning, and put a nice rod in the guy's leg. While the patient is still unconscious, they put the patient back into x-ray to see if the rod was in good shape and everything else, and because we're going to avoid osteomyelitis, that is a bone infection, so you have to do these things right. Anyway, it turned out that the callback from x-ray was, George, great job, wrong leg. Somebody flipped over the x-ray, and in his good leg, he broke it and put a long pin in it. Meanwhile, the bad leg was not worked on yet. So the guy woke up with 2 broken legs. And the lawsuit, of course, that followed indicated that he was now at much greater risk than he would have been before, because now he has both legs in a cast, and that's so not a good idea. So basically, those kind of things, where you can't get the patient up, that's why we see patients walking around with the IVs in their arms, they're spying out, and that's because to prevent pneumonias, to get their circulatory system working well. There's lots of physical changes on the lower respiratory tract. So patients that have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, people who are heavy smokers, all that kind of stuff, they're at risk. Diabetics and alcoholics, we're going to learn more about it later, but they have an impairment of their immune system. In the case of the diabetic, there's glycosylation of the blood vessel wall, sugar sticking to the wall, glycosylation, and that prevents the easy access or egress of phagocytic cells. So phagocytic cells can't get out, and so they're at risk for infection as a result of that. In the case of the alcoholic, leather, we tan leather by cross-linking the proteins. It's a biochemistry thing, right? So that's what tanning leather is, cross-linking. Well, alcoholics cross-link tan, in a sense, the lining of their blood vessels. And so they're at increased risk for infection because they can't get the phagocytic cells through that tan layer to get outside the blood vessel. They also have portal hypertension from all that already, right? But that's parting of the arteries and so on. And that's the same process. So diabetics and alcoholics have problems relative to getting infections. Their immune system is not completely normal. So they are at risk for infections. And they're at risk for increased risk for infections of the lower tract of the diet. As we already mentioned, then we have asthmatics, which we're going to deal with asthma patients and treat them early. Big problem, talk a little later when we get the immune system. But asthmatics, particularly African Americans in urban areas in the United States. We don't understand that epidemiology. Why? Don't know. But it's there. Okay. So they need to be treated very young. We often don't see them until their teens and 20s. By then, they've had 50 or 20 years of untreated asthma, and they have chronic scarring, and they have increased risk for infections, and so on. It's all of it. Depression. Now, this is not angst over an exam. Okay, this is not just sort of feeling down for a day, but this is a situation in which someone is continually sad, if you want to put it that way. They're depressed, and this has lasted for weeks, months. It can go on for years if it's not treated. It interferes with eating and sleeping and all kinds of bodily activities. And so they are not performing at their normal best. And we still have a problem. It's the social stigma to mental illness kinds of problems. You know, tough it out. You can do it by yourself. Yeah, well, it helps you get a little drugs on occasion. Okay? And you wouldn't try to say, tough it out, you've got a bacterial infection. You'll get better. Yeah, you might get better, but you know, you can get better a whole lot better and quicker if you took some drugs. So there is an appropriate use of things, and for that, for depression, you can have solutions. But depression is also an interesting neurological problem because there's a connection between the immune system and the brain. Not well understood. But what happens is that a person who is clinically depressed is immunologically suppressed. So a person who is depressed has an increased risk of getting infection. And there's all manners of data that you can collect. It's really simple to find. Husband and wife have been married for 75 years. There was with a couple on CNN. They were sitting on a park bench in England. They were 100 and some years old. They've been married for like 80 some years. Wow. And they asked, of course, the fellows, I'm sorry, they asked the fellows, you know, what's the secret of success? And he says two words, yes, dear. So whatever she said went, and they all lived happily ever after. Well, shortly after that, within months, she died. Happens when you're 108 or whatever. She died, and within a few weeks after that, he died. This is an extremely common phenomenon. And one patient's death triggers the death of a close relative, husband and wife kind of thing. Depression. Your immune system was suppressed and it came down with bacterial infections and died. So a person who's depressed has increased risk for bacterial infection. So we have to put that into our little house chalkboard kind of thing. Okay, we can treat you with depression, but we also have to keep an eye on, you know, things such as lung infection. I don't have on the list, but you should also include on the list malnutrition. Now, we don't see malnutrition as a big deal in the United States. It does occur. And certainly pockets on Native American reservations, pockets in urban areas, pockets in rural areas, Appalachia, and so on. But it's not like what we see in third world countries. Okay? In the developing world countries, this is a much more common problem. People starve to death. So when we're malnourished, it's a problem. In the United States, we have usually more problems. Well, not usually. We definitely have more problems being overweight than starving. And they may be malnourished because given the free choice of eating food, they eat the wrong ones. But that's a free will choice of some sort, influenced by advertising and so on. but that we have diet dog food. Cycle 1, 2, 3, diet dog food. I mean, this is not found in rural countries, I guarantee. Dogs aren't found that much either. Anyway, so predisposing factors. So anytime a patient has pneumonia, we have to go on this list and figure out why. If we can't figure out why, then we're going to get it again. We're going to do a case study. George. Case study George. George is 64 years of age. He's in the hospital because he has pneumonia. He had pneumonia last year, too. Another thing we should put on our list. A history of pneumonia that had to be treated with bacterial infection, antibiotics, bacterial infection, leads to scarring. Scarring increases the likelihood of getting pneumonia again. So a history of pneumonia increases the likelihood of getting pneumonia. So he's already got a strike again. So why? Let's go more into George here. George is retired, and he retired at age 60. He was a millwright at the plant. At the plant, he had lots of friends and so on, and had a big life and looked forward to retirement. But in fact, when he retired, he had nothing to do. In fact, his identity was lost. He was a millwright, and now he is nothing in his own mind. People look forward to retirement, but then, in fact, they lose their identity, because their identity, particularly in the United States, our identity is associated with what we do. When we no longer do it, we go through an identity crisis, just like we were when we were 15 or something like that. Okay. So we have these people who are newly retired are not adapting well to retirement. He's depressed because he's depressed because he's just retired. His wife died last year, but it didn't bother him. That's what he says. But his dog died about 3 weeks ago. Bothered him. Unresolved grief. Obviously, he's concerned about his wife dying, but he never dealt with it. You see, tough guy. Right? So he's really depressed. Unresolved grief is a depression. You can go in the textbooks and the states and grieving and do all of that stuff. Unresolved grief. So he's depressed for a couple of reasons. He smokes more now than he did before, and you know he's right-handed because you can tell it. He's got this yellow nicotine stain on his right hand. He always has a cigarette in his right hand. And this cigarette smoke is going up his arm, so you can see this yellow stain. 4 packs a day for a chain smoker, so whatever, it's always got one. So that's not a problem. He was told that he had a touch of sugar when he was at the plant, but he didn't have to do anything about it, so he didn't. He's diabetic. In fact, he's also an alcoholic because he's a very big fan of local animal places. He goes to the moose and the elk and so on, okay? In fact, his daily routine is he doesn't eat breakfast. He goes and he goes to the moose and the elk, and he helps them clean up in the morning from the night before, and he has a couple of shots and a beer and a sandwich or something along the way. And then by certain times of the day, he's in certain locations. So by 4 o'clock, he's at this place, and that place, and there, and whatever. But his caloric intake is the alcohol. And he's probably taking 15 to 20 ounces of alcohol in a day. He's not considered himself an alcoholic because he's not falling down drunk. Well, he's not falling down drunk because he's stimulating, inducing the production of an enzyme, remember the induction process, inducing the production of the enzyme alcohol dehydrogenase, and his liver is really working overtime. Of course, it's beginning to become scarred itself because of that extra stress in the liver, cirrhosis. And you probably get portal hypertension and all that kind of good stuff. But it's not quite there yet, but he's working on it. So he's an alcoholic and a diabetic, smokes too much, he doesn't eat properly, and he's depressed. And he has a history of having pneumonia before. Huh. Okay. I mean, this guy's walking case. This is why you have, you don't have to have just one of these things. People don't just have one of them. If you have a whole bunch of them, yeah, that's what they are. So what's going to help this guy? We're going to treat him with antibiotics and get him out of the hospital in a week. He's going to be back next year. And it probably won't make it beyond about 68. A lot of friends put me in the room and then go to the bar and celebrate. However, his sister came to visit him, and his sister, as it turned out, went to high school with the nurse. And they're talking in the hallway, and they said, you know, George has got a problem here. He's not with it here. He's not going to make it. What do you mean? You're treating with antibiotics? Oh, yeah, we can treat him with antibiotics. That's not going to save his life. He's going to die anyway. He won't make it at 70. Maybe 68. But there's something we can do. For the two former high school girlfriends figure out what they can do. They line up George with Annette. Annette's husband died a few years ago, and she's the same age as George. George gets a girlfriend. And she's got things that she's doing, and that he starts doing, and he's now driving meals on wheels with her. All those poor people who don't eat right, he's helping them. Okay. And he doesn't have time to go to all the bars because they're doing all these charitable things. And he is getting his glucose level checked, and he's got his diet now, and he's given up smoking. Hardly ever drinks anymore. They're busy with things. They go to church and they go to community things. And this guy's going to live to be 85. So what saved him? Lifestyle. Lifestyle is killing him, and lifestyle will save him. One of the problems you will deal with patients is you'll have this idea, I can help them if I give them this drug. Well, yeah, but it may not save them. Helping and saving are lifestyle change, very difficult to do. Lifestyle change can take a whole bunch of effort by a whole bunch of people over a long period of time. Lifestyle are important in chronic diseases like depression and diabetes and alcoholism. They're also important in terms of just simply wellness programs, trying to get people to be healthier, lose some weight, change their body mass index, all those kinds of things. That's what really results in long-term healthiness. Lifestyle change. That's what's going to reduce in the long, again, I'm going to be in Ireland and I'll be toasting you, but when you deal with this issue of dealing with health insurance and the cost of health insurance, one of the answers is to have healthier people. Go figure that one out. Where'd that come from? Right? And how do you get healthier people? Wellness programs. Better eating. We have free choice to eat all the wrong stuff or all the right stuff. We have a free choice to exercise or not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you can't really easily do that one-on-one, but you have to do this collectively. So lifestyle changes can change a lot of this. Okay? Change those risk factors. But without them, patients get diseases, such as pneumonia. In pneumonia, we have two different categories of pneumonia. If we have the invading organism inside the alveolar sac, we call that alveolar pneumonia, inside the sac. And that tends to be bacterial, not all bacteria, but most bacteria. And that tends to be lobar, meaning it's localized in the lobe of the lung and usually at the distal portion, the lower tip of the lung. So on X-ray, again, you're not seeing the organisms on X-ray, but you're seeing the inflammatory response. The immune response to the organism. That's going to be where the organism is, hopefully. And that's going to be the tips of the lung. So when you see a big lobar kind of thing, you typically think it's bacterial. But that assumes the person is upright and walking around. If the person isn't upright walking around, they're lying flat on their back for whatever reason, then we see that bacterial infection spread more evenly throughout the lungs. Because now the lower portion of the lung is the back of the lung because they're laying on their back. Okay? As opposed to the lower portion of the lung being the tips, the distal portion of the lung. So assume the person is upright walking around, it would be the lower portion of the lung where we see the alveolar inflammation inside the sac. Interstitial pneumonia is typically associated with such as things as viral pneumonias. And interstitial is the tissue between the alveolar sacs. That's typical of viral pneumonia. There's some exceptions there. Mycoplasma, that's a T-cell mitogen, tends to be interstitial. So mycoplasma pneumonia is spread throughout the lung. Viral pneumonia is spread throughout the lung, even though you're upright and walking around. It's interstitial, not in the alveolar sac. So there's some variation there, but generally speaking, lobar, alveolar, most bacteria, interstitial, scattered throughout the lung, typically viral, but not exclusively viral. And also could be something like mycotoxin. We can classify them pathologically, primary, secondary, metastatic, and should be metastatic. Metastatic. S-T-A-T-I-C. Anyway, primary, secondary, metastatic, and aspiration. Primary pneumonia, that's the initial site of infection. Initial site of infection is in the lung. Secondary pneumonia means a second agent. Second agent. Typically, we have a viral infection, which further debilitates the protective immune response of cilia movement and so on. It changes the amount of secretions, it changes the efficiency of the immune clearance system, that bacterial toilet. So a person who gets a viral pneumonia is at risk of getting a bacterial pneumonia. So another risk factor there. So first, primary viral, second organism, and that is bacterial. That's why we're concerned about influenza. Not everybody who gets influenza is going to die of influenza. They may die of a bacterial pneumonia. So we're concerned about preventing the initial infection, which then sets them up for the second infection, which kills them. Nursing homes, for example, we're very keen on getting everybody immunized against influenza, protecting against influenza, preventing patients from having lots of visitors during times of epidemics and so on. Not that influenza could kill them, it could, but it also increased the risk of getting a bacterial pneumonia, which also could kill them. Which also means that in some of those patients that are at risk of the bacterial pneumonia, we may give them antibiotics as a chemoprophylaxis, even though their initial diagnosis is simply viral. Now, that's a tough call, but it depends on the age of the patient and risk factor. If you have a 90-some-year-old person with viral pneumonia, this could go to bacterial pneumonia before you get a chance to treat the bacterial pneumonia to die. So what you want to do is, that patient has to be treated carefully enough, maybe we'll start using antibiotics, even though they don't have, at this point, a recognizable bacterial infection. So primary viral, secondary bacterial. But there are other examples of those kinds of primary secondaries. And here we have metastatic means it's spreading from one location to another. A patient could have poor oral hygiene, have an impacted tooth. Now, we may think that they're going to get that treated right away, but what happens is we have different kinds of abscesses in the roots of teeth. The dentist calls them hot and cold abscesses. Okay? And we have an abscess that is really painful, hot. But a cold abscess would be one that if the organism, the pain is in part because of the pressure building up of the organism trapped in an area of the abscess. If the abscess leaks, then you lose out organisms, and therefore it doesn't hurt as much. And so it comes and goes and comes and goes. It's not that it's not as serious. It's just that it's not being seen as serious by the patient because it doesn't hurt as much. And so they have this chronic condition of repeated pain, abscess, leaks out, pain goes away, etc. But where does the organism go when it leaks out? The patient can aspirate the organism. So we get an organism that's an anaerobic organism growing in the abscess. It's aspirated, and it's spreading from one part of the body to another. That's metastasis. We normally think of cancer being metastasis. It's really something spreading from one place to another. So we can have metastatic kind of pneumonia, which means we need to find out what that original source was. Okay. And it also means patients with abscesses in the oral cavity, for example, are at increased risk of getting problems in their lungs. Aspiration is simply the aspiration we talked about. That is a patient with a history of a near drowning episode, a patient that may be an alcoholic that aspirates various kinds of things. Organisms and so on, aspiration, getting fluid in your lungs and contaminating your lungs with organisms, but also would be true then of someone who's had a long-term surgery. So if you had a 20-minute gallbladder, not a big deal. If you had a 16-hour three-organ transplant, big deal. Okay. So unfortunately, the patient whose immune system is already stressed out, we're going to stress it out further by having a long surgery. One of the reasons why we like surgeons to know what they're doing is to do it quickly and correctly. Etiologic labels. This is 50-50. Remember, it was 90-10 before. Half of viral and fungal, half of bacterial. Superinfection. That's stuff. This quote today, if you ever give me another name. Superinfection is this idea of a secondary infection. The first infection was viral. Second infection is bacterial. It's called a superinfection because the rate of increased seriousness of that second bacterial infection is greater than if it had been a bacterial infection alone. That's why that 90-some-year-old person with the viral pneumonia had significant risk of getting a bacterial pneumonia, and it might get serious before we get the chance to treat it. That's why we think about using such things as prophylactic use of antibiotics. Again, looking at our lower respiratory tract, same thing we saw earlier, but the lower respiratory tract. We'll talk about influenza, of course. Coccidioides immitis. Coccidioides immitis is also known as San Joaquin Valley fever. This is a fungal infection. Coccidioides immitis. San Joaquin Valley fever. Also known as desert fever. What happens is we inhale the spores, fungal spores, and get them into our lungs. Now, most people, when they do that, and the organism germinates, will produce both an antibody response, so-called humoral immunity, antibodies being in body fluids, and in the aqueous humor of your eye, that means body fluid in your eye. So humoral immunity means fluid immunity, means antibody. So most people produce that, and they will most of them produce a cell-mediated immunity, CMI, cell-mediated immunity. Which is T cell response. So we have B cells producing plasma cells producing antibody, and we have T cells giving us a cell mediated immune response. We have a dual system. However, a small percentage of the population, less than 5%, will produce antibody only, at least as their initial response. Antibody only will not protect you in this case. In this case, these patients then develop a fungal infection in the lungs. We can treat this with such things as amphotericin B. However, amphotericin B has serious side effects. So what we do is we buy time for the person's immune system to convert and produce a strong T cell response, a CMI response, in which case they'll survive. If they don't, they don't. Okay, so this is someone who is driving through San Joaquin Valley area in California. Stopped off and had a Dairy Queen or a sandwich or a beer or something, and then further on through the trip they were exposed, and as a result of that exposure they end up with a fungal pneumonia and die. And we can't quite pick out who's going to have that faulty response. There are research approaches, but nothing clinical yet, that will stimulate that person to produce the appropriate immune response. They're not there yet, but we're working on it. Bordetella pertussis. The agent of whooping cough, the bacterial agent, Bordetella, gram-negative organism. Bordetella pertussis agent causes whooping cough. It's part of the DPT immunization to pertussis. Cough medicines are called antipertussants. So you see Bordetella pertussis, think of coughing. You can whooping cough. Whooping cough, the child gets a whooping sound. Whooping cough. Okay. It's a strong contraction of the tracheal area that creates this higher pitch, and so the kid can actually cough to the point where they lose their breath, and they can start turning blue and all that sort of stuff, panic and all that kind of thing. High fevers are also possible, can lead to meningitis. The main problem initially is in the lungs. And it can be fatal. Whooping cough can be fatal. But we protect you by immunizing you with the DPTs, and the DPTs, the P is pertussis. We use a and kill preparation of the organism. It's sort of a German Yiddish term, is a gemisch. And so we put this all this stuff together and we use it. Kill preparation. It works fairly well. It does have some side effects. Can trigger an autoimmune-based attack on your brain. So it can cause an immune-based encephalitis. And we'll talk more about that complication. We'll talk about the vaccinations and immunizations a little later. Verticella pertussis, again, not commonly seen in the United States because we immunize against it. Not because we are somehow special breed of people or anything like that. Not our diet that we're immunizing against it. If we don't immunize, we see it. Streptococcus pneumoniae, of course, we'll talk about. Coxiella, Brunetti, don't worry about that one. Chlamydia, chlamydia organism. Remember, we had two kinds. One was psittacosis, that was the bird problem, right? Sometimes it's called parrot fever. You can see chlamydia causing a lung infection. But again, it's usually associated with somebody with something to do with pigeons or birds or something. So we see that one, you know, one of those things you put up on the house chalkboard and go, wait a second, why this? There's something about this patient that puts them at risk. If we don't figure that something out, we treat them and they go back to doing whatever they've been doing and they get it again. There's not sort of a morbid curiosity about the patient. It's we're trying to prevent repeated infection. And other people that they have working with them or playing with them, their bird transferring club or whatever, the racing club, the kids racing club, maybe, you know, other people might be at risk. So you prevent disease in that patient and a cluster of infections if you figure out what their problem is. Influenza virus. Obviously a major concern currently, and let's go into more detail. We want to look at the structure and biology, the epidemiology, develop the vaccines, and some complications. Guillain-Barré syndrome and Reye syndrome. And then later we'll talk about CMV, another agent. We're just looking at influenza virus here. Here we see the virus. It's a segmented RNA virus. We don't call it different chromosomes, but they're like different segments to it. Seven, to be exact. So seven segments. We have a lipid layer. Of course, that lipid is bilayers from the host because it's released by what process?
Budding.
Budding, okay. And on the surface of this, we have certain structures, hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. Hemagglutinin is involved with receptor site matching. Antibody to the hemagglutinin is associated with protection. Makes sense. Now, hemagglutinin gets its name because it causes red cells to clump. So if you mix the virus with red cells, the red cells clump. That leads us to a serological test in which we add antibody into that as a third party, that is red cells, antibody, and virus. We mix the virus with the antibody and then we see if it causes clumping. The higher we can take a patient's sera and dilute it out and still prevent the clumping, the greater amount of antibody that the patient has. We call that a titer. Remember the dilution of the reciprocal, the highest dilution that gives us a positive test. In this case, we're looking for the inhibition, the blocking of that clumping phenomenon. Full sera does it. Dilute 1 to 2 does it, 1 to 4, 1 to 8, and so on. Maybe 64 or 128 or whatever, someplace out there, it stops. So the highest dilution that gave us the clumping, we take that as a reciprocal, and that's the titer. So we have a hemagglutination inhibition titer, or an HI titer. Hemagglutination inhibition titer, an HI titer. Hemagglutin is not exclusively found on as a structure, as a functional structure, not exclusively found on influenza virus. We find it on measles virus and so on. So if you want to know if a woman is susceptible to measles virus, we could do that as well. We can do an HI titer there. We might want to know that if we have a woman that's going to get pregnant or is early stage pregnant, and we want to know about their likelihood of getting infections and having the child be infected. If they're protected, the child will be protected. So we'll do that HI titer for other agents. Neuraminidase is an enzyme involved in the release mechanism. So in the budding process, it helps separate. It helps the release of the virus to get off the host cell. Both H's and N's can be serotyped, and we have a wide variety, hence the idea of H1N1 and so on. Three different basic serologic types, A, B, and C. And we also have, in addition to that, serotyping, we also have the N's and the H's. So influenza A, for example, has multiple serotypes. You can see some of these. H1N1, H3N2, and so on, and you can see the various kinds. The avian influenza is H5N1. We'll talk about that in a second. Here we have an isotope family picture here. You can see the membrane on the outside. Each vaccine is going to be for a particular serotype, both H and N. If you've had the infection before, you've had exact H and N types, of course you're fully protected, but you also get a margin of protection, partial protection, if you have had just one of them. So remember they are segregating separately. So H1N1, maybe you have an H1N2 come around, and therefore since you saw the H1 before, with H1N1, you're protected to a large degree against H1N2. So there's some cross protection there. So definitions. Epidemic, pandemic. We're talking about the degree of cases, how they are spreading. A localized cluster is an epidemic. We have an epidemic in Muskegon. We have an epidemic in Chicago. Pandemic is a worldwide epidemic. We have a problem in Muskegon, Chicago, Hong Kong, and London, Madrid, and so on. The general public gets confused about this. They tend to think that when something is a pandemic, that it's associated with high rates of death. It has nothing to do with the number of deaths. It's merely the number of infections. CDC, I was at a meeting, International Vaccine Society meeting last May. The woman in charge of the World Health Organization would come talk to us. But she had to turn around and she landed in the fence to go back because they had an emergency. Of course, it was H1N1 problem. But the part of the emergency was they had these little, like, the code, color codes, you know, this level, that level, that level. And they were concerned about worldwide panic associated with the telling everybody there's a worldwide pandemic. Communication about whether there's lots of deaths or not is separate than whether we have infections throughout the world. And again, what happens when people panic is they overrun the healthcare system. All those walking well clog the system, get infected while they're in the hospital, remember the SARS story, and they get infected in the hospital, plus, most importantly, they clog the system up and they have trouble triaging everything else. So you have to be careful about public relations announcements, World Health Organization affecting all the countries in the world. So they have a problem, and they're actually in the process of changing the definition of pandemic and coming up with another set of words to describe that it's not highly lethal, it's just highly infectious. Antigenic shift and drift. Point mutation. And it's one of the reasons why we have this ongoing change in vaccines each year. They're slightly different. Antigenic drift is a result of genetic reassortment because of co-infection. And the co-infection results in a major change. So a drift is a minor change. A shift is a major change. And so generally when we have a drift, we have, you know, epidemics and pandemics and new vaccines and all that kind of stuff. Whereas the normal one, it's pretty much routine. We know the result of vaccines for the seasonal kind of thing. So if you think of antigenic drift as the seasonal flu and why we have to have that, and then think of antigenic shift as this newer problem with H1N1. That's why, for example, this year we have two kinds of flu vaccines. We have the seasonal one, which has been out already. You may have already had it. And then the vaccine. And then we have the H1N1, which is representative of the shift. And we have the great new vaccine. Why don't we cease the discussion at this point and go to the review? And we'll talk more about pandemic. Questions?